And now I'll introduce our first chair, which is Gloria Dubner. Go ahead, Gloria.
Good morning, everybody, and let's start with the science. It's my pleasure to invite Sean Raymond to talk about understanding supernova remnants and study. What do we learn from X-ray observations of supernovae and supernova remnants?
Thank you, John. Thank you, Gloria. It's good to see so many people here, so many new faces. Some of you know that I love the details of supernova remnants. I love all of the little twists and wiggles of the filaments, the obscure plasma physics of collisionless shock waves, the obscure atomic physics processes that only happen in the ejecta, the cold ejecta of supernova remnants. But for today, what I'd like to do is take a step back. There are a lot of people in the world, in the world now, making very large models of the formation of galaxies, the evolution of galaxies. And they don't care about any of these details. They just want a few numbers, which basically come down to the feedback. They form some stars within their model. The stars explode. They generate turbulence and fast winds and things like that. So from their point of view, they don't care about the stuff that we know and love. They care about a lot of, but just a handful of numbers, really. But before I start, I'd like to just take a few moments to remember Mike D'Apoda. Mike was supposed to be here at the last meeting, but couldn't make it because he fell ill, and he died in December of last year. Mike made a huge number of very important contributions to our field through the models of the emission of shock waves, and also through his analysis of a lot of really spectacular observations. He was perhaps equally well known in the for his photoionization models in the fields of AGN and H2 regions and planetary nebulae. So Ivo Seitensal will be talking a little bit more about some of his contributions on Friday. So going back to the question of what people doing simulations really want to know from us, they want to know about the progenitors. How many of the stars that they form are going to explode? When will they explode? Is there a big delay? They want to know how much kinetic energy is injected, but that's not necessarily the amount that is produced by the supernova itself. They may care only about what's left after radiative losses take a lot of that energy away, because they may not even resolve the whole supernova remnant that we study. They need to know how many heavy elements are produced, because they need to know the radiative cooling in order to follow the evolution. They want to know how much dust is made and how much of it survives, because a lot of it made in the supernova is not going to survive. And they should like to know how much of the energy goes into cosmic rays, although a lot of the models don't really treat that. So the first thing you have to know is whether the supernova remnant that you're looking at is type 1A, formed by a white dwarf, or type 2, formed by corpuscle collapse. And there's been an awful lot of progress in recent years. You can find, you can determine from the symmetry, this is work by Lopez et al, where you have all of the core collapse supernova remnants up here and all of the type 1As down here in a plot that is just due to the symmetry, the quadrupole and octupole moments that you can get just by looking at the thing. You can also look at the K-alpha centroid, Yamaguchi et al, that basically tells you the ionization state of the reverse shocked gas. And again, there's a nice separation between type 1 and type 2. And of course, if you see a neutron star coming out of the remnant, this is very recent work on CTB1, fairly spectacular example of this little trail behind the neutron star of a pulsar wind nebula. You can also find out a lot from the morphology of the supernova remnant. In particular, this is some work by Milosavljevic and Fiesen. You can find out if the ejecta form a ring, for instance, or if they form jets, the importance of rotation. So you can determine quite a bit about the progenitor of the supernova that way. And here's another interesting example. By looking at the ratio of iron to silicon, that's telling you essentially what the composition of the star was during the explosion. And you can separate into, by looking at the ratio of iron to silicon, estimate of the progenitor mass using models. So it's really become possible to find out quite a bit about the progenitor star just in recent years. This is another study by Katie Okadal, looking at the composition, looking at supernova remnants, and basically looking at the places where they're formed, looking at the star formation history in those regions, and figuring out what the IMF was, basically the progenitor mass, compared to a Saltpeter relation and what's observed in other galaxies. As far as the type 1a progenitors, the big question has always been whether it's a single degenerate or a double degenerate system, and what the delay time is, how long it takes for the white dwarf to evolve and actually explode, whether this might depend on galactic metallicity, for instance. And it's important to know whether these things occur inside planetary nebulae. So there's a nice example, again, very recent, a very fast white dwarf. And this is work by Shen et al., who took the Gaia data and looked for very fast white dwarfs that would be formed when you have a double degenerate system. One of the stars explodes and the other goes away at 1,000 or 2,000 kilometers per second. They found several nice candidates, and one of them, D6-2, this is where it is now. You can extrapolate its proper motion, which is very high, into the future or into the past. And it turns out that going into the past, it leads into the center of a very large supernova remnant discovered by Fiesen et al. Just a few years ago. And knowing that the white dwarf is associated, you get a distance of a kiloparsec and an age of 50,000 years, which tells you the two basic numbers you need if you're going to use this to study the evolution of a supernova remnant. In this case, in the galactic halo, this is the image from Fiesen et al. In H alpha, you can see it's just this kind of diffuse blob, but it's enormous. It's 4 by 5 degrees on the sky, 350 parsecs from the plane. So you can study the evolution of a supernova remnant in the galactic halo. And just in case that image of this smudge in H alpha is not very impressive, this is what they actually saw when they looked in detail. This is a mosaic of several H alpha images. You can see the very nice filamentary structure all along the side here. And of course, this is just a small piece of the remnant. But it's very faint. It's not real easy to study. It appears to be fairly slow shocks, 60 to 90 kilometers per second in low density gas. Here is another example of the way to tell a type 1 supernova remnant. These frequently have pure Balmer line filaments. This is work on N103b, another type 1b in the type 1a in the LMC by Gavamian et al. It has these characteristic very broad profiles in H alpha, a two component narrow and broad profile. The fact that you're seeing this neutral hydrogen here means the gas has not been ionized. And Kutila et al. Have pointed out that you can show then that the progenitors were not super soft sources. I believe there's a poster on that later at this meeting. But another interesting aspect of all of this is the interaction with the circumstellar medium. This is the example of Kepler, which has been a big puzzle for some time. 600 parsecs from the galactic plane, nevertheless, the density outside the supernova explosion is fairly high, 10 to 1,000 per cubic centimeter. So there seems to be a substantial amount of material there, which probably was left over from mass loss by the companion. There is an overabundance of nitrogen, as Katsuda et al. Found, although Dapita et al. Say that that may just be due to its position within the galaxy. There seems to be dust from the progenitor. There seems to be a high velocity of the centroid of this thing towards us, if I remember right. There's no bright companion there. It's been suggested that it occurred inside a planetary nebula, although the ears show strong silicon and sulfur ejecta, which suggests that that actually has more to do with the explosion. And it's been suggested that this is a core degenerate kind of scenario. Next question is the kinetic energy. Are they all really 10 to the 51 ergs? There are a lot of subluminous and superluminous supernovae that have been seen in the last few years. And again, the question is how much energy is really left after they radiate away a large fraction of it. because that is what really is the amount that's injected into the interstellar medium, which is the amount that's important for a lot of these modelers. So in order to determine the energy accurately, you need to know the distances. And there's been some progress on that recently. Again, thanks to the Gaia satellite. This is a paper by Rob Vizan et al. This little guy up here actually appears to be interacting with the supernova remnant. When you look at it in at higher resolution, you see absorption lines, which are blue shifted but not red shifted, indicating that it's actually in the remnant. There's also a molecular cloud over here, which has a lot of dust, and the distance to that dust is known in a catalog from Green et al. So the distance is settling down at 735 parsecs, not far at all from what it was when I was writing my thesis a long time ago. And as far as the energy remaining after radiation, this is a paper by John Slavin et al. Again, this is the energy that actually drives turbulence and governs future star formation. In a 1D uniform medium, you can do this pretty much analytically. Don Cox did this in 1972. You radiate away half the energy in the EUV as it cools and forms a dense shell. This is a more realistic medium, but it's not extremely realistic. This sort of filamentary structure is what you actually expect in a paper by Ifrig and Hennebel. But again, this is the energy that drives the turbulence, and the feedback is very complicated. Again, you need to know the heavy element production for cooling and diagnostics. You want to look at things like the R-process elements, the iron to oxygen ratio. And you can measure this from X-rays, but it does have some requirements. You have to separate the ejecta from the interstellar medium. You need the temperature and the fluence, the product of density times time, which determines the ionization state. So you have to fit all of that simultaneously. You need to know the density, so you need to know the filling factor, which is often difficult to determine. You need to know how much dust there is, because what you want is really the total amount that's ejected. You have to be a little careful about bremsstrahlung from helium and carbon, because that provides extra continuum. So you have to think about that when you're getting the total abundances. And it's important to have spatial resolution. I think the spatial resolution slide is missing. Because if you mix together a lot of different temperatures, you get the wrong answers for the temperature and therefore the abundances. But this is just an example from some time ago of the importance of heavy elements as a diagnostic. The chromium and magnesium lines, which you can see here, pretty weak in Tycho, can be used as diagnostics for the explosion mechanism, as Carlos Badenis in particular has been pointing out. Here is the spatial resolution one. So this is a million second observation with Chandra of Cas A. You can see that the iron, the silicon and iron abundances are very different in different places. If you do not have the spatial resolution and mix them together, you will not get the right answer. And this is just another sort of thing to be careful of. When people are modeling these things, they used to just assume ionization equilibrium. Now they assume that the gas is ionizing. But in some cases, the gas is actually recombining. It's changed significantly from that. This is another paper by Yamaguchi et al. This radiative recombination continuum is what tells you unambiguously that the gas is recombining. And again, you have to have the ionization rate in order to determine the elemental abundances. And dust has been a major question in this field for some time now. First, how much is made? You can find that out in some cases by looking at the supernovae themselves. 1987A in particular is a good example. But then the question is how much survives? Both dust in the ejecta and dust in the AGB wind that preceded the supernova explosion, because that's going to be subject to a strong shockwave. This is a very recent paper by Priestley et al, looking at Cas A. The different colors here indicate the unshocked ejecta down here, This is the total contribution to the emission as a function of wavelength, the shock ejecta, and clumpy material in red here. So what they get with this particular model is a little more than half a solar mass of dust that's formed, but a lot of that is not surviving. The hot gas components only have a thousandth of a solar mass. And it's important to point out, just because people often forget about it, this is a paper by Kula et al. A few years ago. This is the ratio of infrared to X-ray emission from supernova remnants, just an observed number. And you can see that it's typically around 10 for all of these different kinds of remnants, which means that the cooling of a lot of supernova remnants is really governed by the dust rather than the X-rays or the atomic component of the gas. So it's a much different cooling rate. And as far as how much actually survives, another paper by John Slavin showing silicate grains and carbon grains for a range of different shock speeds. The very fast ones are very efficient and destroy almost all of the dust, but a fair amount survives as you get down to the lower shock speeds. And as the remnant evolves, it's mostly spending most of its time, most of the volume covered at these low shock speeds. So a significant amount survives. Mike Dapita did a paper on N49 with a truly spectacular spectrum. There are just hundreds of lines here looking at the destruction of iron. And what he concluded is that the iron is not sputtered away in the high temperature part of this gas, but when it cools down and is compressed, that spins up the dust grains so they collide with each other and shatter. And finally, just to mention cosmic rays, as a general kind of principle, people have believed for a long time that something like 10% of the energy goes into cosmic rays. They behave very differently from normal gas, partly because of the gamma equals 4/3, partly because they diffuse through the galaxy, and partly because they're immune to radiative losses, although they do have other kinds of losses. And supernova remnants have been favored as the source of cosmic rays up to about 10 to the 15 electron volts for quite a long time. So one question is whether that 10% really works. Is that a good number? So this is an example from Lukovi et al. This is supernova remnant 0509 in the Large Magellanic Cloud. This is an image in H-alpha showing this very nice circular ring. And they have a proper motion, you know the distance to the LMC, so you know the shock speed. So you know what the temperature should be for any given shock speed. In this case, the shock is very, very fast. Depending which part of the remnant you're looking, it's 3,000 to 4,000 kilometers per second. The temperature of the ions can be gotten in some cases from the line widths and in some the electron temperature from X-rays, but that's typically a small contribution. And you can measure these things and look at the efficiency. In this case, what they found is that the efficiency is relatively small, but it depends on this F0, the fraction in the neutral phase of these Balmer-dominated shocks. Another signature of cosmic rays is precursors. These are two papers, one by Lee et al., showing a piece of the Tycho supernova remnant. On the left side of this, the shock wave is moving to the left. You can see this very faint sort of precursor ahead of quite a lot of it. That is something that is a required part of shockwave acceleration of cosmic rays, at least within the diffusive shock acceleration picture. The difficulty is that it's hard to know whether this comes actually from the cosmic rays or from neutrals behind the shock that manage to stream out ahead of the shock. Morlino has done quite a lot of work on this. But this is an example from Knežević et al. In which they are looking at the precursor. This is for a fairly fast shock, density of 0.1. And they have different models depending on whether there are no cosmic rays at all or a lot of cosmic rays. And you can see there's quite a lot of difference in the structure of the precursor you get in these different pictures. And of course, the way we're really finding out a lot about the cosmic rays just within the last few years is the gamma rays. This is a paper by Acero et al, just to show a nice example. W44 is an old remnant in which the gamma rays are primarily hadronic. These others are type 1a supernova remnants, much younger. They have a very different spectrum as primarily leptonic shell remnants. An interesting feature of this is the cutoff somewhere around 10 to the 13 electron volts, which is something of a problem if you are hoping to explain all of the cosmic rays up to the 10 to the 15 EV. So I'd like to just end with a slide on where there is room for improvement. This is more of my personal take on it. As Rob Fiesen said, I have to talk about my own research here rather than talking about the general field. For many years, we've been using these one-dimensional steady flow models. Gas comes into a 130 kilometer per second shock, gets heated to a little over 200,000 degrees, and begins to cool down. As it cools down below about 100,000 degrees, it begins to produce oxygen 3 emission, this dashed line here. As it cools further, it recombines, but then it starts absorbing all of the EUV photons produced upstream, making something that looks kind of like an H2 region. So the cool lines, sulfur 2, H alpha, nitrogen 2, are in principle formed in this very diffuse region back a significant distance behind the oxygen 3. You have a very clear prediction for what the structure should look like. There should be a sharp filament in oxygen 3 followed by a few arc seconds by this more diffuse sulfur 2 H alpha region. But if you look at this Hubble Space Telescope mosaic from the Heritage Project a few years ago, this is reality. The blue is the oxygen 3. The red and green are sulfur 2 and H alpha. And it really doesn't look like that. You do see fairly nice, reasonably sharp filaments in oxygen 3. But they're not followed by a more diffuse region in the cooler emission. They're followed by all of this rather horrible, somewhat unrelated structure in the cooler emission. There are a few places you can pick out that do look something like the one-dimensional models, but in general, it really doesn't resemble that. So there's a lot of work required here to figure out, because the Cygnus loop is a very nearby remnant. This is HST resolution, so it's 10 times better resolution than what you have normally from the ground. So if you were to look at a filament in the LMC, this whole thing would be collapsed into a pixel or two. You wouldn't have any idea that this incredibly complicated structure is happening. So it's a very interesting question, how this turbulence is developed, what governs it, how it works, and how it affects the spectra, and then by way of that, how it affects the abundances that we derive when we look at spectra of this thing. So I've left a lot out because I didn't have a lot of time. These are just things that have caught my attention within the last couple of years. The interaction with the circumstellar medium, I think, is a region of overlap of interest between people who study supernovae and people who study supernova remnants. The QSFs in CAS-A are sort of the best example of that, but I also showed Kepler as an example. Supernova remnants in superbubbles. How can we see them in the first place? They go off in this very low density medium. It's very hard to see, but they may be the most important contributors to the cosmic rays. I didn't say anything about molecules at all, mostly because I don't know very much about molecules. And I didn't say very much about the radio, again, because I don't know very much about the radio. So there's a lot left out. A lot is being covered. Many of the things that I mentioned, there are going to be posters or talks later in this meeting devoted to exploring those things in more detail. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sean. Sorry for introducing wrongly the title of your talk and Dan Fadnaud.
I think I changed it.
Understanding supernova remnants and galaxies. So we are open for questions. Yes.
Not so much a question as a comment. This is Bill Blair. I just wanted to highlight the Cygnus loop distance that you mentioned, John, because as you know, a number of us have spent a long time trying to get the distance to the Cygnus loop. And while the value seems to have settled down close to the old Minkowski number, it has gone up and down by a factor of two or so from that in more recent work until we finally nailed this down. And when you can kind of consider the Cygnus loop as a prototypical object, you know, to have the distance uncertain by such a large factor it has been a real bugaboo. And so the fact that we have finally nailed it down to a value allows us to take advantage of that wonderful resolution and know the distances and know the scales of things with certainty now. And Gaia has allowed us to do that with the Cygnus loop, possibly for some other objects as well we should be looking at as well. Although obviously the Cygnus loop is close enough by that I'm still tired, I'm jet lagged. The uncertainties are small there, so that's really a good example. But anyway, I just wanted to highlight that because I think it's a really interesting story that's taken us decades of effort to get to that one number, which is the 735 parsecs. So.
Just to sort of highlight the importance of that, there's been a lot of discussion over the years about whether the Cygnus loop was formed within a cavity, a lot of discussion about the energy of the explosion and things like that. And now it turns out that it actually fits a Sadov solution really quite well with an age of 20,000 years and things like that. So I think we have a much better idea of the energetics and the interaction with the interstellar medium.
More questions or comments? Okay.
Parties.
John, you were talking about the origin of the half solar mass of dust in Cas A. Was the finding that you could account for, or they could account for all this extra dust by having the dust to gas ratio being much higher in the clumps than the rest of the ejecta, or how was that conclusion reached, the amount of dust?
So the amount of dust is just from the infrared emission. So that doesn't have the gas to dust ratio in it. You need an estimate of the gas for that. So this is just the straight amount of dust that you need to account for the IR.
We still have time for more questions if there are interest or comments. Yeah. Yeah, we thanks Sean.